The documentary from the BBC World Service brings the globe to your ears through original documentary storytelling. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 23rd of April, these are our main stories. Fierce fighting in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, is hampering efforts to evacuate foreign nationals trapped there. Islamist militants in Mali have killed at least 9 people in what appears to have been an attack on a Russian military camp. Police in Kenya say they've found more than 20 bodies during an investigation into a cult which allegedly urged worshippers to fast themselves to death. Also in this podcast...
The only difference really between me and the viewers is that I'm rich and talented and they're not. That's the only difference!
The Australian comedian Barry Humphries, best known for his character Dame Edna Everidge, has died at the age of 89. As fighting continues to rage in Sudan, efforts to evacuate foreign citizens are gathering pace. A group of around 150 people from the Gulf, Egypt and Canada managed to escape after travelling in a convoy to a port in Sudan, from where they sailed to the Saudi port of Jeddah. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said among those evacuated to Jeddah were diplomats and international officials. But efforts to rescue other foreign nationals are being hampered by gunfire and explosions in Khartoum. Millions of people remain trapped in the Sudanese capital, many without power or water supplies. Iman is a British citizen who's currently in Khartoum visiting relatives. She's been in touch with the British Foreign Office and is still waiting to hear from them about how she'll be evacuated.
Yesterday we got an email saying now you can register your name. So I've registered my name, my daughter and my son. And since then, nothing. It's just utterly frustration. There is no human contact whatsoever.
Our correspondent, Kalkida Nyubeltal, who's following the story from Addis Ababa, gave us this update.
There seems to be an intense fighting and some of the residents were describing it as very intense. As we enter into the second day of a supposed 72-hour truce, there are hopes that when the two warring parties, when the army and the rapid support forces or the RSF agreed to a three-day ceasefire on Friday, that things might start to pause a little and civilians trapped in the conflict could be evacuated and people in need of help could get this medical and other like food supplies. But that didn't happen. And it seems that the fighting has a sort of fluidity, which is to say that there are times or there are moments when there appears to be a certain silence, a certain pause in the fighting. But moments later, gunfires return and the city is inundated with sounds of explosions and then heavy shelling. So it seems that as we enter into the second week of this violence, we're not seeing any de-escalation, particularly in the capital Khartoum. And the airport, particularly the international airport, is located in the center of the city and it's not that far from the command base of the army. So it's been a setting for intense fighting since the beginning of the violence last week and seems to continue that way on Saturday as well.
And the fact that there's so much fighting around the international airport is really making it extremely difficult for foreign countries to evacuate their nationals.
Yes, indeed. That's been one of the problems. So far, we have seen the first rescue operations when a number of foreign nationals arrive in the Saudi Arabian city of Jeddah. But they seem to have been conducted through a coordination of, you know, road travel. The foreign nationals seem to have driven from Khartoum to Port Sudan, which is located more than 500 miles to the east. And then after that, they were transported by ship into the city. So it seems that since the intensified fighting is happening around the airport, foreign countries have found it very difficult to coordinate and even plan for evacuating their nationals from this city, which is essentially now a war zone.
Kalkidan Yebeltal. Military officials in Mali say an army helicopter has crashed in a residential neighbourhood of the capital, Bamako. An army statement said the helicopter was returning from what it called an anti-jihadist operation and that there were possible victims. The crash came hours after an ambush by suspected jihadists on a military camp in the central Malian town of Sévaré, which left at least 9 people dead and 60 others injured. It seems the attackers may have been targeting Russian nationals, as our correspondent, Myeni Jones, who's based in Lagos, explains.
The target appears to have been, and obviously we don't quite know what their motivations are, but to have been this base that was housing Russian nationals. Last year, the Malian military that runs the country invited what it calls Russian military instructors to come and help them in their fight against the various Islamist groups that have been targeting the country and carrying out attacks in the country. Now, the US and other international countries say that these instructors are in fact mercenaries from the Russian Wagner group. This is something that the military has denied, but I think it's widely accepted that Wagner is present in Mali and is helping the Malian forces fight the Islamist groups there. Getting accurate information about Wagner's presence anywhere in Africa is incredibly difficult. I myself have been looking into their presence in Central African Republic, where they've been for many years, and as soon as their name comes up anywhere, people immediately tend to kind of shut down and be very wary. They don't want to speak. So it's unclear exactly how many of them are currently in Mali. They deny being anywhere else, but there are indications that they may also be in neighbouring Burkina Faso. This is something that they've repeatedly refuted. So it's unclear exactly how many of them were at this base, particularly because they like to keep their operations pretty secret.
Myeni Jones. Police in Kenya say they found more than 20 bodies during an investigation into a cult which allegedly urged its members to fast themselves to death. Grant Ferret reports.
The leader of the Good News International Church, Paul McKenzie, has been refused bail since he was detained a week ago. He was held after police discovered 4 bodies. Since then, about a dozen people have been taken to hospital. Some of them were described as being emaciated. Police said they'd been told to starve themselves in order to meet Jesus. Now a search of a forested area near the coastal town of Malindi has led to the recovery of more bodies. Mr. McKenzie has not yet been asked to enter a plea, but he's denied wrongdoing and says the church was shut down several years ago.
Grant Ferret. In Ukraine, the military says that unprecedentedly bloody battles are taking place in the eastern city of Bakhmut, where they have to repel up to 50 Russian attacks on their positions every day. Moscow has concentrated massive forces in this area, and its brutal strategy of launching so-called human wave attacks is helping its troops to advance slowly, albeit at a very high cost. The BBC's Abdul-Jalil Abdul-Rasulov has spoken to Ukrainian fighters who have just come out of the city. They told him stories of heroism and brutality on the battlefield there.
Private Sigan is lying on a bed, unable to stretch his shriveled up leg. He has just been discharged from a hospital and is now staying in a dilapidated dormitory room in Kyiv. Tsigan is his call sign. He was at a forward observation post when a tank shell hit their position.
There was a bright flash. I was thrown onto the logs with such force that it nearly crushed me. I couldn't understand whether I was dead or alive. Someone was shouting. It seemed like the sound was coming from 100 meters away.
It was Senior Lieutenant Pavel Kuzin's voice. Tsigan could barely move, and Pavel had to drag him from the dugout. Then he went back to get others.
One man was buried under logs, another was completely covered with earth. If the Russians had stopped firing, maybe Pavel would have been able to get them out too.
Shortly after, Russian infantry launched an assault. The 206th Battalion, in which Pavel served, had fought in the southern Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv regions, but the battles over Bakhmut were very different from what they had seen before. Mykola Glabets, platoon commander.
The intensity of fighting to break through our positions was shocking. They attacked our positions without any cover. They wouldn't even hide. Sometimes Russian soldiers would get as close as 20 meters from us, crawling and moving under a tree line or across an open field.
Mykola Glabets describes these groups as a suicide squad, but such wave attacks, similar to World War I tactics, are bringing some results for Russia, albeit at a very high cost. Mykola Glabets again.
They discover where our machine gunners are positioned, where our grenade launchers and mortars are, and then Russian artillery and tanks start hammering those positions.
That was the danger Pavel knew he faced as he rushed to his Browning machine gun. But as long as he kept firing, his wounded brothers in arms had a chance to be rescued. Pavel saved their lives, but died himself.
That report by Abdul-Jalil Abdurasulov. Savagely funny, a comic genius, an all-time great, just some of the many tributes that have poured in for the legendary Australian comedian Barry Humphries, who has died at the age of 89. For many, he'll be better known as his flamboyant alter ego Dame Edna Everidge, whose purple-tinted hair, extravagant glasses and biting wit delighted audiences for decades. Another much-loved character of his was the uncouth, lecherous, hard-drinking Sir Les Paterson. Our correspondent, David Slitto, looks back at Barry Humphries' life and career.
Dame Edna Everidge!
Hello, Potter!
Dame Edna always said she was born with a priceless gift, the ability to laugh at the misfortunes of others.
I am weightless, and you could do with losing a little. Success has gone to your jowls, Russell Hardy.
Oh, you're being very, very cruel.
For more than 50 years, she took pleasure in saying the unsayable.
I'm trying to think, Sharon, of a word to describe what you're wearing. Affordable. That's it.
She was so familiar, it was easy to forget that behind the glasses and frocks was a man called Barry Humphries. He arrived in Britain in 1959, an Australian comedian with a devilish delight in satirising the people he had grown up with.
Most of us who go to England try to get rid of our Australian accents if we can, because we've always felt, with our accents, rather inferior, you see, to our English cousins. As indeed we are.
The real Barry Humphries was an art lover, a painter, a collector of rare books. Polite, a loyal friend, the opposite of another of his characters.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Les Paterson is her name. Oh, here we come. A couple of latecomers creeping in here. Oh, she's beautiful too, son, eh? Oh, I think we can guess what kept you, eh, fella?
But he and Sir Les did have one thing in common. Drink. It took a divorce and a spell in hospital to convince him to give up the booze in 1971. But throughout his life, he always had Edna.
Let me help you put your finger on my single greatest asset. It's my nice life.
For many, Edna was so real, so engaging, it was easy to forget that the wit, the charm, the sheer audacity was all down to the brilliant comic mind of a man called Barry Humphries.
The only difference really between me and the viewers is that I'm rich and talented and they're not. That's the only difference!
David Slitto with that look back on the life of Barry Humphries, a.k.a. Dame Edna Everidge, who's died. Still to come on the podcast...
Champion!
Wrexham, the small football club bought by big Hollywood stars, celebrate their return to the English Football League.
The documentary brings together the best of factual storytelling from across the BBC World Service.
This is a historic opportunity for peace.
To end violence for good in Northern Ireland.
Exploring the world around us. And bringing the globe to your ears.
The invasion meant that the lives of millions of Iraqis changed forever.
There are still some memories that I can't talk about.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. As North Korea ratchets up the development of its nuclear weapons, South Koreans are increasingly talking about the need to develop their own nuclear deterrent. Even the president, Yoon Sung-yeol, has mentioned the idea. What worries South Koreans is whether the US would really step in to defend them if the North attacked. This week, President Yoon is heading to Washington to meet Mr. Biden in search of reassurance as pressure for Seoul to build the bomb grows. Our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Jean McKenzie, has been on a quest to understand what is driving people there to want to make such a mammoth decision.
If ever you needed a reminder that North and South Korea are still at war, this is it. I'm standing on a beach watching as dozens of military boats approach from the horizon. They're storming the shore. The sand spews everywhere as smoke bombs explode, blanketing the air in a purple haze. The US is practicing how it would defend South Korea in the event of a North Korean attack. With nearly 30,000 of its troops stationed here, that's the commitment the US has made to South Korea.
But doubt has started to creep into South Korean minds. Now North Korea has developed nuclear weapons that can target US cities. Would Washington really come to South Korea's defense if it meant facing the nuclear wrath of Kim Jong-un?
I'm hidden away in the private room of an underground restaurant in Seoul, where a disparate group of politicians, scientists, and academics have gathered for a clandestine lunch. This is the inaugural meeting of the Nuclear Policy Forum, which is pushing for South Korea to go nuclear. The head of the forum, Dr. Chong, is a seasoned academic, now in his early 60s, and he walks me through his plan.
If North Korea tests a nuclear weapon, South Korea should withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. If in 6 months, North Korea has still not agreed to give up its nuclear weapons, South Korea should develop its own.
This would reduce the likelihood of a nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula, he argues, by keeping the North Koreans in check.
The Korean public is on their side. A staggering three-quarters of people here now say they want their country to develop nuclear weapons. But the critics say people don't understand the consequences. I've come to a Korean sauna to find out what people think. If you want a slice of Korean life, this is the place to come. People duck in and out of the sauna ovens, and they cool off outside on mats, drinking beer and eating fried chicken.
We are surrounded by great powers and we are walking on eggshells around them. To be competitive, we need to have nukes.
Have you thought about some of the negative consequences of South Korea getting its own nuclear weapons? That the US would no longer defend you, that you were on your own?
If the US wants to abandon us, we should be rethinking our friendships.
If we were to become the axis of evil, I think it's not worth it. But I do think it would be better to be independent from the US. Our relationship with the US is good now, but relationships can change.
This problem is partly of America's making. In 2016, President Trump threatened to pull U.S. forces out of Korea.
At some point, we have to say they have to protect themselves or they have to pay us. Here's the thing.
The fear those words instilled in people here has not lessened with time. Koreans know that America's promises are only as good as its next president. But it wasn't until the South Korean president suggested going nuclear that this once fringe idea exploded.
I've come to meet Yang Uk, who was in the room when the president made his remarks. Gone are his days protecting ships from Somali pirates. He now advises the government.
He's not saying that we're going nuclear right now.
But he is the first South Korean president to put this option on the table.
I mean, that's how serious this North Korea situation is. The U.S. is really, really reluctant to discuss the nuclear issue with Korea.
Seoul's politicians are tired of being kept in the dark with no understanding of what would trigger the U.S. president to push the nuclear button on their behalf.
the U.S. president, it's his decision. Right now, there's no requirement for him to actually even call the South Korean president to say, hey, I'm going to do this or not do this, and let them weigh in on it.
Jenny Town runs the Washington-based think tank 38 North, which monitors North Korea.
Washington does not want South Korea to have nuclear weapons. More nuclear weapons in the world doesn't make the world safer.
Jenny Town from the think tank 38 North, ending that report by Jean McKenzie. BBC Persian has received confidential documents showing that the Iranian government formed a so-called celebrities committee to punish public figures who took part in the recent protests for women's rights. It was set up 6 days after Mahsa Amini died in police custody. She'd been arrested for not wearing her hijab correctly. Pictures of her in a coma after she'd apparently been beaten sparked widespread anger, leading to months of demonstrations in which many women ripped off their hijabs and set them on fire. Paham Gobadi reports.
One document indicates that the Ministry of Economy and Finance was asked to provide financial information on more than 140 actors, sport and other well-known figures last September. Another document names the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, Mohammad Mehdi Ismaili, as the committee's chairman. One of those named told BBC Persian that social media influencers were threatened by officials with taxes on all their online activities if they continued to support the protests.
Paham Gobadi. For decades, creationists in the United States have tried to stop schools teaching the theory that's generally accepted as the best way of explaining how life on this planet developed, the theory of evolution by natural selection developed by the British naturalist Charles Darwin. Now, halfway across the world, schools in India have also stopped teaching Darwin's theory to the horror of many scientists and teachers there. The authorities say this is simply to reduce the burden on younger students in the post-COVID period. But in the past, some members of the governing Hindu nationalist BJP have said Darwin's theory is wrong and have questioned how humans can be descended from apes. Our South Asia editor, Ambarasan Etirajan, told us more.
Officially, the Indian education officials are maintaining that in the post-COVID period, they wanted to revise the syllabus and what they call as content rationalization to reduce the burden of students in the post-COVID period. So they made some changes, but this was found out by one newspaper. They highlighted what are the areas they missed out. In fact, as an interim measure, they reduced the syllabus by even omitting Darwin's theory of evolution as well. But now, this year, they found out it has been made permanent. That's why there has been a lot of hue and cry. And hundreds of scientists, teachers and educators have now issued an open call to the government asking them to restore the theory of evolution. Now, why this is happening? Because you have to read it in the bigger context of what's happening in India. For example, many Hindu nationalists, they believe in their, you know, in the mythology talking about how the human beings were created by God, Lord Vishnu. And one of the minister, previous minister was quoted as saying that, you know, Indians were born because of the sages, Hindu rishis, not from through the monkey. So they don't believe in this theory of, you know, ape and the link between ape and the humankind. So this is all going in parts of, you know, the revival of those feelings. And that is what the critics would say. You know, this is in a bigger picture of happening, you know, rewriting some of the changing chapters and questioning established scientific values. But the government official position maintains that it was done only to reduce the burden of younger students.
Well, that's the government position, but there are also concerns about other parts of India's history being expunged, notably the Muslim history, for instance, the Mughal rulers of India.
These are all part of the changes in the textbooks for year 9 and 10 in the secondary school students. And this, again, another controversy about dropping, erasing what the Muslim ruled during the Mughal Empire for 300 years. And if you look at the, you know, major landmarks in India like Taj Mahal or the Red Fort in Delhi, they had a lasting influence in terms of culture, architecture, language. But now, many of the, you know, Hindu nationalists would feel that they were being ruled by the invaders or Muslims who came from outside. And this is all part of what the critics would say the nationalists are trying to erase India's history and rewrite history.
Ambarasan Etirajan. Saturday was International Record Store Day, celebrating independent record stores around the world and the important role they play in promoting new music. There's been a big focus on the revival of vinyl in recent years, but another format is also seeing a comeback. Here are some clues. The sounds, of course, are of the old-fashioned cassette. There are more now being brought back than in 2003, with big-name artists like Harry Styles and the Arctic Monkeys releasing music on tape. Tony Villa is a cassette tape aficionado who runs his own YouTube channel devoted to the genre, Cassette Comeback. So what's behind this surge in popularity?
If you've got cassettes now that you'd recorded back then, guess what? You've still got them. You can still play them. No monthly subscriptions, no internet access needed. The thing about humans as we are, what's new and whiz-banging shiny like streaming becomes ordinary, then becomes boring, and we look for something else. And since they've never created a new consuming music format since streaming, we go back to the old formats again, because ultimately you do remember the cassettes. You will remember sitting there recording things. Mm-hmm. You maybe remember doing mixtapes, and those are tangible items. They don't just excite your ears, they excite your sight and your sense of touch. There's something that you can own, and they become endearing. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm a Luddite. I love streaming because the amount of new music I've discovered that way is phenomenal. But sometimes, as the old say, you know, nothing worthwhile is ever easy. And there's a lot of tracks and albums that I love that it took time to love them. Because I couldn't just skip to the next track instantly, like you're on your Spotify, it's like 10 seconds in, nope, next. You had to listen to them. And ultimately, they went into your mind and you started to appreciate them simply because you had to, at the first, suffer through them. But eventually, you grew to love them. I mean, in modern world, technology has given us a lot of convenience, but it's taken away a lot of magic at the same time.
Tony Villa, a cassette tape aficionado. 2 years after Wrexham Football Club was bought by two Hollywood stars, the fairy tale continues. The Welsh club is back in the English Football League for the first time in 15 years after beating rival team Boreham Wood 3-1. The BBC's Sohail Sahi was watching.
Red flares, red smoke, you can smell it all around the racecourse. The Wrexham players have been absolutely mobbed. Paul Mullin, you can see he's standing up there. He has got 38 National League goals. It's absolutely jubilant around here, and Wrexham will be back in League Two next season for the first time since 2008.
And the Wrexham team continued their celebrations in the changing room.
Champion! Champion! Ole, ole, ole!
They now have millions of fans across the world after the club was bought by Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. Their documentary about why they bought an ailing club in North Wales called Welcome to Wrexham has gone global. Just after the match, Rebecca Kesby caught up with a former BBC journalist, Maxine Hughes, who was the Welsh translator featured in the documentary and is also a huge Wrexham fan.
We were all holding our breath. We're in Washington, D.C., so, you know, it feels a bit strange being so far away. But, you know, I was there with the kids. We've all got our Wrexham shirts on. And, you know, I can't believe it. we hoped this would happen last season. And then, you know, obviously, this has just been the day that we've all been waiting for, you know, for so many people, not just in Wrexham, but, you know, across the world really now.
Well, quite. I mean, you say that you're so far from home, but you're sort of home from home, aren't you? Now there are so many American fans for Wrexham.
Yeah, it's amazing how things have changed, actually, over the last couple of years. I've been in the States for several years and, you know, nobody ever really knew where Wales was, never mind Wrexham. And now sometimes I'm in small towns in, you know, places like Florida and somebody says, oh, I really want to go to Wrexham and drink at the Turf. It's amazing that people have just got on board with this story. It's unbelievable. And for, you know, I'm Welsh speaking. So for me, and my dad is from Wrexham, so, you know, there's just such a personal story for me as well. Just, you know, seeing how Wales has been given this platform and, you know, North Wales particularly.
And the language, of course.
Of course, yeah. I mean, look, unbelievable, you know, to hear Welsh on this sort of Hollywood platform, to hear Hollywood stars try their best at speaking Welsh. Rob particularly has done very well. But, you know, they made a conscious effort from the beginning. You know, the first promo we did when we announced that the series would be happening, they chose to do that in Welsh and English, which is how I got involved. They needed a Welsh translator in Los Angeles, which is not that easy to find. Yeah, they made a conscious effort to not only be respectful towards the Welsh language, but also to incorporate it into the show.
Do either of them have Welsh ancestry? Is that where the interest came from?
No, they don't actually. Rob's is Irish. Rob's from Philadelphia. Ryan's from Canada. You know, Rob and his producer, Humphrey Kerr, were looking for a football team to buy and a story, a really good story. And, you know, they were looking around the world. They heard about Wrexham. You know, Rob needed somebody else on board with some Hollywood money. So, you know, they got Ryan involved, and the rest is history, really. But I think for Rob particularly, you know, he grew up in Philadelphia. It's a working class town in Pennsylvania, actually, that has big connections with Wales. A lot of Welsh miners went over to Pennsylvania to work. And he grew up sort of seeing Welsh names around him, because there's lots of Welsh names in Philadelphia, but didn't know that they were Welsh. And, you know, years later now, he's obviously got this connection to Wales, and he started saying, oh, I've realised there were all these Welsh names around me. But, you know, I think when he looked out at Pennsylvania, and then when he first came to Wrexham and looked out at Wrexham, you know, he really saw something very similar and felt a cultural connection. And I think that's been something that's been really important to him particularly.
Wrexham fan Maxine Hughes. We all know that parrots have an incredible ability to pick up new skills and mimic others. Well, now a study in the US has shown they can learn to make video calls, and doing so might make them feel less isolated. Iona Hampson has been finding out more.
Eleanor makes a video call with Theo.
There's your friend Theo.
What makes this interaction remarkable is they are both parrots who have been taught how to make a video call using a tablet computer. A transatlantic team of researchers helped teach 18 pet parrots in the US how to make the calls. First by encouraging them to ring a bell.
Do you want to call a friend?
Then tap their beaks on the tablet screen to choose which of several parrots they'd like to speak to.
Ready? Do you want to talk to her? You do? Okay.
What surprised the researchers and owners was that after 2 weeks of training, the parrots were asking to make video calls without being prompted. In the wild, parrots live in flocks, but about half of the world's 100 million parrots live in captivity, where they are often kept alone or in small groups. Experts say isolation and boredom can cause the parrots to develop psychological problems, which can be shown by rocking, excessive pacing, or self-harm-like behaviours, including feather plucking. The researchers concluded that teaching parrots how to make video calls improved their well-being and even allowed them to learn skills from each other, including singing and preening.
Eleanor, who would you like to call this time?
So how do you become a popular Polly and have lots of pals? Well, the researchers found the parrots that called the most had the most parrots calling them back.
Iona Hampson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.